Welcome to Trial Lawyer Review. My name is Jason Lazarus, your host. This podcast is for and about trial lawyers. We'll tell the stories of trial lawyers who go to battle every day in courtrooms throughout the United States for injury victims. And this will be about their stories and about their practices. Hello, everyone. I'm Jason Lazarus, your host for Trial Lawyer Review. Thank you for tuning in today for another episode. Trial Lawyer Review is brought to you by Synergy Settlement Services. In full disclosure, I'm not a professional podcaster. My day job is Chief Executive Officer of Synergy. Synergy allows trial lawyers to focus on what they do best by handling the difficult issues at settlement, like complex lien resolution, Medicare secondary payer compliance, public benefit preservation, and complex settlement planning. Joining me today on Trial Lawyer Review is Elise Sanguinetti, a highly skilled and incredibly well-respected trial lawyer with the law firm of Arias Sanguinetti, Wang, and Porrios, law firm in California. She is the founding partner of that law firm with offices in San Francisco, Bay Area, LA, Las Vegas, and Montreal. Her main focus of expertise is serious injury, wrongful death cases, civil appeals, and legal malpractice. She exclusively represents plaintiffs in civil litigation and holds an AV rating with Martindale Hubbell and has been named a California super lawyer every year since becoming eligible. Elise has been recognized as one of the top plaintiff lawyers in California over the past 8 years and was named one of the top 50 women lawyers in the Bay Area. She graduated from the University of San Francisco School of Law, where she earned her JD. She was admitted into the California State Bar in 1997, 1 year after myself. When not in the courtroom, she's a frequent speaker at nationwide seminars and writes articles that are featured in various legal publications. Her copious amount of work has been recognized with numerous awards and various organizations. It is an impressive list. I've seen it all. She's a past president of AAJ, a past president of the Consumer Attorneys of California, and a past president of the Alameda Contra Costa Trial Lawyers Association, which is a mouthful. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Elise.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome, and thank you for joining me. So to start out, can you talk a little bit about your law firm and your practice?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. We started this law firm about a little over 5 years ago, excuse me. And we started it because we really wanted to be a full service plaintiff's law firm. We joined together partners that did all sorts of different types of plaintiff's work. I really grew up in practicing plaintiff's law, doing mostly product liability and individual personal injury cases. Some of my partners' focus had been on class action and mass tort work, complex litigation of all sorts. And we have one of our partners in Las Vegas had practiced as a defense attorney handling medical malpractice cases, and had been practicing handling plaintiff side medical malpractice cases for years before we brought him into the fold in our firm. We wanted a place that felt like family, to be around people that we really enjoy practicing law with, and to surround ourselves with staff that are top notch and really, really care about the work that we do. And myself and my partner, Mike Arias, are very active in trial lawyer organizations across the country. He's a past president of the of CAOC, Consumer Attorneys of California, which is our trial lawyer, our state trial lawyer organization, which I'm also, as you mentioned, a past president of. He's also a past president of the of CALA, which is the Consumer Attorneys of Los Angeles, which is a almost as large as our statewide organization. And so we've both spent a lot of time, we've spent a lot of time devoted to not just helping individuals as much as we possibly can in our practice, but also trying to focus on making a change for consumers across the state and across the nation. And that's really what our mindset has been in organizing this firm and representing people. It's all about giving a voice to people that otherwise wouldn't have a voice.
And I want to come back to that after we talk a little bit about you, because you've got this incredible history of service to different trial organizations. I want to talk about that in a moment. But first, what led you to become a trial lawyer in the first place?
So while I was in law school, it was the summer of my first year of law school. And it's kind of that time that's a little hard to find work at a law firm. And I went out there and just kind of hustled to try to see where I could find some summer work, because I really wanted to immerse myself in a setting where I would learn in real time what it was like to be a lawyer. And I worked for a personal injury, a solo practitioner, and I learned so much. He brought me to trial that first summer. Actually asked the judge for permission to allow me to question a witness during a personal injury case. And I really did get the opportunity to see everything firsthand about what it was to be a plaintiff's trial lawyer. And then I clerked for two judges in Contra Costa County who were handling civil litigation. And I got to see the other side of it from the judge's point of view, and watch so many great trial lawyers go in front of a jury and argue their case. And I just knew at that point that that was really what I wanted to do. So when I got out of law school, I was lucky enough to get a job really, really close to where I lived. I live in Walnut Creek, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I joined a prestigious plaintiffs firm that was located in Walnut Creek and started, just representing people, which was what I wanted to do. I wanted to make a difference and be in the courtroom, because those were the two things that mattered to me. And I knew I wanted to do it on the civil side. So I was lucky to kind of get that dream job right out of law school, and have been practicing plaintiff's law ever since.
In my third year of law school, I did a clerkship for a federal judge in the Northern District of Florida. And that was an incredible experience, getting to see from that side and watching the lawyers appear in front of the judge, and listening to the judge and working with the other judges, clerks in that office was a pretty cool experience. And ironically, it was right around the time that F. Lee Bailey was having his troubles and was actually in the courthouse there while I was there. So it was kind of a strange time, but really, really cool experience to see it from that side of the bench.
Definitely. And I think it gives you a perspective of, especially with legal writing, because there's so that you do so much of that as a law clerk for a judge. It gives you a really great perspective of what's important to the court, and to really hone in on those important issues and kind of leave out the garbage that you see so much in briefing. It's a really important thing to learn early on, because as you know, most young lawyers come out of school and they're focused mostly on briefing, and to have that ability to know what matters to a court, it's really critical.
Yeah, interestingly, I read a lot of habeas petitions written by inmates, and you know, it was funny because they would use certain buzzwords which would get them past it just being summarily dismissed. But interesting that you talk about legal writing. I agree 100%, but it just brought back that memory of reading through these 20 pages of handwritten documents and, you know, just with a few constitutional buzzwords thrown in all throughout. So interesting to talk about that. Can you talk a little bit about your experience as a young trial lawyer? I know you that's where you started getting very involved with AAJ, with the New Lawyers Division, but just curious about your experiences and whatever you want to talk about, whether it's just your experiences as a new lawyer or coupled with the New Lawyers Division.
Sure. So on the work side of it, at the firm that I was at, I the timing of me joining the law firm, which was Hinton and Alford at the time that I joined it, when I started, we were just beginning a three-month trial involving a rollover accident where there were multiple deaths, and it was against one of the big car manufacturers. And because of the timing of me starting there, I was able to immediately get involved in preparing for that trial. So I really got thrown into the deep end right when I started on difficult legal concepts, and also got to really immerse myself in a really lengthy, complicated trial as soon as I began there. So I was so lucky because, you know, so many young lawyers don't really get to be that involved in trial work. I've always been, every firm that I've been involved in has really been focused on actually being in the courtroom and actually trying cases, which was one of the reasons that it was very important to me from even a young age to kind of get to know other lawyers that did what we do. Because I wanted to learn as much as I could. I didn't want to just kind of learn just from my immediate surroundings, but I started to realize how much you can learn from people in other jurisdictions, how they do things differently. And my senior partner at the time, Peter Hinton, was a board of governor for ATLA, for what was AAJ was formerly known as. And he encouraged me to come to a convention. And I went to my first real convention that I went to, that I traveled to, was in Atlanta. And I kind of remember it like it was yesterday, although it seems like a lifetime ago. I went into a new lawyers meeting. And that was it's a membership group subsection of the organization. There's the Women's Caucus, Minority Caucus, and the New Lawyers Division. And just being out of law school and only practicing for a couple of years, I really wanted to have a sense of community. And so I went to that meeting, and that's immediately what I found. There was lots of opportunity to get involved, and I saw that and volunteered for something and was just really welcomed with open arms from all of the other new lawyers from across the country and the leadership in the New Lawyers Division, and started doing small things, working on publications and gathering articles for the New Lawyers publication that they had at the time. And then that kind of grew into raising money for PAC and trying to raise membership, trying to get other new lawyers to join the organization. And then eventually, within a few years, I ran for office for the New Lawyers Division and eventually became chair of the New Lawyers Division, which is the largest membership group in the organization. So ATLA at the time and now AAJ. And it provided me with so many opportunities it provided me with access to get more involved in education, to not only learn from trial lawyers across the country, like some of my heroes, Russ Herman, who ended up becoming not only just a great friend, but almost second father to me, and so many others that the list is just so long of people that I've been able to get to know and become really good friends with through first learning from them and then teaching with them as my skills grew. So that was kind of my intro to organizations, and there's so many benefits that come from it, and I'm happy to talk about those as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to dive into that. But you know what is sounds like an incredible experience getting to, you know, walk into a very complex auto case, rollover case. Did you find any challenges when you entered the practice being a woman in what is generally a male-dominated type of practice?
So, my law school class was just a little bit over 50% female. I'm going to take you back a little bit further because I think it's helpful to know my background. I am the youngest of six kids in my family, and there's a huge age difference between me and my oldest brother. We're 24 years apart in age, and yeah, big difference in age. And but being the youngest, with I have two brothers and three sisters, and so by the time I was born and growing up, my brothers were out of the house, and it was just a really strong female family unit with a incredibly supportive dad who encouraged all of us to really get out there and do whatever we wanted to do, that there was really no limits. And my mother was definitely the same way. My parents owned a company, an import company, and they traveled around the country. And so I always just knew, I didn't feel that I ever had limits. I really, really believed that, and I still do. And I grew up with such strong, dominant women in my family, that everybody was just really goal-driven. And when I went to law school, I had a really strong group of girlfriends where we focused ourselves on our goals. And then coming out of law school, going into my first firm, I was, all the other lawyers were male besides myself, but their support and their encouragement was so strong that I never felt marginalized in any way. And it was a really incredibly supportive environment. I think the first time that I kind of felt a gender bias in any way was more with interaction with opposing counsel. And yeah, that started to come, it came a little bit with also bias against youth and I'll call it inexperience, just assumptions made that you can, that you don't really know what you're doing when you walk into a deposition, or, you know, the old thing that you hear about, walking into a deposition, being asked if you're the court reporter. I mean, I really honestly don't know a single female lawyer that hasn't happened to. It really honestly does happen. Being degraded a little bit during depositions with objections that are gender specific and targeted towards you, it happens. It was jarring to me when it first began. But again, being undeterred in my goals and representing my clients the best I could, it never derailed me from what I knew I needed to accomplish. It didn't distract me whenever it did happen. I would stay focused on my deposition, on whatever I was in the middle of doing, if it was in trial, if it happened in trial or in court, also would not get derailed, which was really important. Having those experiences really was important to me to be able to make sure that I was helping other young women as they were growing in the legal field. Because I didn't feel deterred, but I didn't want anyone else to feel deterred. And I wanted them, I wanted others to make sure that they didn't feel that they didn't have a place as a plaintiff's lawyer, as an advocate for others, because of a few bad apples. And so mentorship and forming bonds with other female trial lawyers, lunch groups, people that you could just, you know, have conversations with about the specific hurdles that women trial lawyers have to face was really critical to me. And it's something that I still find incredibly important to do for others.
Yeah, you know, sign of a professional yourself, an accomplished professional. But, you know, one of the things that I hold very dear is this idea of professionalism in the practice of law. I actually have a law practice that's separate from Synergy, and I do some litigation with Medicaid liens here in Florida. And I always love when the judge will compliment both counsel on their professionalism and how everything was handled, because to me, that's a really important part of that. It's sad to hear. I had not heard that gender specific, objections during a deposition. That really is very unprofessional. And just, I hope that as the profession continues to evolve and we have more women trial lawyers, I should have asked you a better question, because really it's that there's really fewer women trial lawyers. The trial lawyer area seems to be more male dominated on the plaintiff side. But, you know, my hope is that we continue to see a trend where more and more women become personal injury trial lawyers, because, you know, this idea of that somehow there's some kind of gender barrier there should not be.
I will tell you that I think that is changing. It has definitely been changing over the last few years. There's a great group that I'm involved in that's called Women in Mass, which is a group of women that do mass tort work. And it's when mass tort work first began, there was a drought of women involved. It really was very male dominated. I would say at a much higher level than your regular PI practice, I don't want to say every day, but your individual PI practice. And that has shifted immensely over the last few years. And I think part of it is because of groups like Women in Mass, that where other women that do that work are there to support each other, share information with each other, and also advocate with the courts to make sure that when leadership is appointed, because those cases are who the judge decides who actually gets to represent the plaintiffs. So it's a different situation than individual cases. The court is much more involved on who takes a leadership position. And because of many strong judges and many strong women that have been involved in mass torts, there has been a dramatic shift and a push towards seeing gender and racial diversity in the leadership of mass torts. And it's made an enormous impact. So there's so much room for growth, but there has been so much growth over the last few years with a focus on making sure that litigation that's appointed by the court is really has an eye towards gender diversity and racial diversity.
Well, it's wonderful that you champion that. I want to talk a little bit about your experiences and cases that you've handled. Is there a particular case that you've handled that you think is really incredibly important or influential, and why?
I get touched by every case that I get involved in, because they're real people. And they're real people that are struggling, because on my individual And the mass tort cases, it's just that the mass tort is such a large number. You don't get to know your cases, your individual plaintiffs very well. But the wrongful death and serious injury cases, when people come to us, they are in a situation that has changed their life. They've lost a loved one, or they're struggling through such a serious injury that it has changed everything about their life. And they come to us for help, and that's really what they're doing. So every one of my cases has really changed me in some way and touched me in some way. And I still stay in touch with so many of my clients. One area that I've been working on lately with my partner, Jamie Goldstein, that's been different for us over the last few years, and it's not an area that most trial lawyers get involved in, is working on cases representing people that have died in jails or prisons. And they tend, a lot of lawyers don't take the cases because they're very specific cases. They're violations of constitutional rights. They sometimes have a mix of medical malpractice in there as well. You're representing people that have been incarcerated. So there's a level of complexity, and there's a bias against those that have been incarcerated. So there's a hurdle that even the most compassionate trial lawyer has a hard time getting past because of a concern of what a jury would do with the case, because you're representing somebody that had been incarcerated for one reason or another. But we have really championed this cause, representing family members of and sometimes inmates of incarcerated and incarcerated individuals. And it's been something that has given us a different perspective on that type of case and the family members involved of who we're representing.
You touched on something that is very near and dear to my heart, which is this idea of empathy and connecting with injury victims, what they've been through. One of the things that I do with our team at Synergy is every month highlight in a mission moment what the facts of the case were and how we contributed to helping that client in the end, because I want them to understand that when people come to us, it is a point in time where they've been through something pretty, you know, awful. If they're needing our help, or they're needing a trial lawyer's help. And actually, I do in our onboarding with people, I talk about the accident I was involved in as a cyclist. I got hit by a car and had some pretty significant injuries as a result. And, you know, I try to put that in context for them, not that my case is important, but just this idea, anybody and everybody can have their life changed in an instant. And that's really the importance of what we do, and trial lawyers, the essence of what you guys do is work with people when they've suffered something really significant. And I'm just curious, how do you connect with clients empathetically with what they've been through, and then how do you disconnect so that you don't internalize it and, you know, have it eat you up? Because some of the facts of cases just can be really brutal.
I think the empathy comes with the type of person that becomes a trial lawyer to begin with. I know it in our firm, it's a belief down into our core. And when we are hiring people to join our firm, we call it our family, we spend a lot of time trying to find out whether or not the people that we're going to bring on board have that same core. Because it is so important to us that whoever, from our receptionist to our partners, that every person that is involved in our cases understands at their core what they're doing and why they're doing it, which is for our clients, to help them, and to understand that when things can get difficult with communication with clients, which it does sometimes because you can't always remain, as in touch as some clients would prefer, or just there may just be misunderstandings in what's happening in the case, that it your response always comes with a sense of empathy. So I think that we work really hard to try to find the right people to be a part of our firm, a part of our family, that feel the same way that we do. As far as disconnecting, I'm not sure that we ever really do disconnect. I think that there is something about helping so many people. You're working on a lot of very important cases that until we get to the point of trial or very close to trial, we're not totally immersed in one. And believe me, it becomes extremely hard to detach yourself once you do become completely immersed in one case, which happens when we go to trial. You know, it becomes our complete focus. Up until then, you're dealing with a lot of people, and so you're managing a lot, and you're managing a lot of things going on in a whole bunch of cases. But once we get close to trial and we're preparing for trial, we are 100% immersed in that one case, and it does become all consuming. I think our family members could speak to how immersed we really do get and how close we get with our clients. And one thing that I find so important, and I want to bring it back to what you were saying about what Synergy does, is that even when we're done with trial or we're finished with a case, we've resolved it, and sought justice for our client, whether it be through settlement, arbitration, or a jury trial, it doesn't finish there. We're not done. There's so much more work to do. And part of that work is working with companies like Synergy, where we truly consider ourselves involved in the case until the family, until the individual is no longer with us. And I mean, literally in a sense of that they're no longer on this earth, because we will always want to be a resource to them. And what we do is we partner with groups like Synergy to then know that the next phase in this journey for our clients is being passed off to someone that has the same mindset that we do. Because the contact becomes less with us and more with companies like Synergy to then manage that next phase in our client's journey, which could be through helping with financial management or annuities to protect a lot of times a minor's money so that they have that money long-term into the future. But throughout it all, you know, I look at it, we've handled so many cases with minors, and I've had people contact me from cases that I did 20 years ago with them and to talk about issues that are arising in their lives and their needs now, and it just doesn't stop. It's an ongoing relationship that we cherish and that we hold very dearly and make sure that our clients know that we're always there for them.
It's incredibly cool to hear you talk about that, just because it really speaks to who and why we want to do what we do, who we do it with, and why we do it. And I talk a lot about that with our team, so it's kind of cool. And hopefully some of them will listen in to this and connect with that, continue to connect with that mission. So I want to circle back to the leadership. So you have been a leader amongst trial lawyers nationally and in your home state of California. What has driven you in that regard?
I was driven early on because I could look at my caseload, even as a young lawyer, and say, maybe I have a caseload of, you know, back then of 40 cases, and I was helping 40 people or 40 family members. You know, I saw that there was only so much that I could do on an individual basis, and I wanted to do more to protect even those that I didn't represent directly. That if I, even if I wasn't the one that they hired to be their lawyer, I wanted to make a bigger impact. And what I saw happening, even back as, you know, well, this has been back since probably the 70s or earlier, that there has been attacks by corporations, those that we try to hold accountable for 40 years plus, 50 years plus, really, have tried to make changes through the legislature in California or and throughout the country, really, and also in Congress in Washington, D.C., to protect themselves and protect themselves specifically from being held accountable. And it has definitely morphed over the years how they've tried to go about doing that. And what I saw at a very young age as a lawyer was that there was only one group in California and one group in Washington, D.C. that fought against that. There's a lot of consumer groups are out there, but there's no one other than CAOC in California and AAJ in Washington, D.C. that is, their main mission is to protect access to the courts. That is their mission. And many other groups that exist have other missions. But I was very concerned about what I was seeing, especially when I would get calls from people who were injured by medical malpractice in California. And I would review those cases and know that there had been a law that was passed back in the early 70s that limited access to the courts for people that were injured in medical malpractice cases. And when you have to talk to somebody and say, I know that this doctor or this hospital did something horrible to you, that the negligence is clear, but your case is capped at $250,000 and our fees are capped 20% or below, and that we will have to spend over $250,000 to try to seek justice for you, I cannot recommend that you move forward with a case against them. And when you have to do that over and over again, and you hear the disappointment and the lack of, you have to explain to somebody the lack of justice that they're able to receive, it changes you. It really does. And it changed me. And it made me say, we can't let this happen again. We have to do everything we can do to try to change what happened in California in the early 70s, but also to make sure that it doesn't happen in other areas of the law and that people remain to be able to have this constitutional right to a trial by jury in a civil case and to hold people that harmed them accountable. And the way that I found best to do that was to work with CAOC, become an advocate for those that I represent and those even that I don't represent, and to do the same thing on a national basis.
So is that why you feel that the trial lawyer associations are so important? Is that, or is there more to it?
There's a lot, actually. It's what drove me to become involved. That in the sense of community, that those two things are what drove me to become involved. But the reality is there's much more than just those two things. The education that you receive, your ability to constantly grow as a trial lawyer by learning from other trial lawyers, by being able to share information with other trial lawyers, which is such a key part of being part of these organizations. Not having to reinvent the wheel when you are becoming involved in a case, a new type of case, or encountering a expert witness that others have successfully dealt with in the past. So the sharing of information, the education that you receive, the obviously the sense of community, and the importance of the lobbying efforts both in California and in or Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. are huge parts of why trial lawyer organizations are just so critical. I mean, they are what keeps our doors open. They truly do keep the doors open, and that the not only our office doors open, but the courthouse doors open.
Courthouse, yeah.
And there's nothing that honestly signifies that more than looking at what happened during the pandemic. You know, in California, I know Florida actually, from what I've heard, is actually really kind of stayed afloat with their court system during the pandemic. But California seriously struggled, and we continue to struggle with an enormous backlog of cases. It's very true, the saying that says that if justice delayed is justice denied. Our clients, if they die during while the case is pending, the case goes away, and that person that caused their death, a company often that caused their death, is not going to be held accountable for it. And so we have to remain diligent about getting our cases through the court system. And when the pandemic hit, our courts were not prepared for this crisis situation. We unlike Florida, who has dealt with a lot of emergency situations with hurricanes and other situations where the court itself may not be open, they can still function. California hasn't really dealt with an emergency plan as well as some other states have. And so in most counties, things just completely shut down. And if it wasn't for organizations like CAOC who got out there and worked with our judicial counsel and our chief of our Supreme Court, who oversees all of the courts in California, they came up together with an emergency plan to very quickly to address things like allowing for remote depositions, allowing for remote appearances, actually mandating it so that the courts could not deny us the ability to appear in court remotely, having some courts think outside the box and allow us to do things like Zoom jury trials, which I was involved in one of the few Zoom jury trials last year. But that without CAOC's efforts, I don't know that we could have gotten to that point of making sure that we were addressing access to the courts during a pandemic, which none of us anticipated we would need to do.
So I want to transition with the time that we have left, talk a little bit about the business, the practice of law, aside from COVID, because obviously that's a huge disruption. Are there things that you see coming down the pike that may change the practice of law in terms of what you do? In doing my research for our podcast today, I noticed a case that you, I think, is still in the works, and it was a wrongful death case involving some technology that didn't function right in an automobile and caused someone to pass away because they couldn't get out of the vehicle after a crash. And it just brought to my mind, you know, this idea of, you know, hey, we may be 10, 20 years from now in driverless cars, but this technology could still, you know, cause injuries and death. And, you know, how does that change the landscape of what it looks like today?
Yeah, it's, I have been, something that wasn't in the materials, that it's really interesting you brought up driverless cars. I have been involved in autonomous vehicle technology and its intersection with the law since I think it's been about 7 years now. So when it very first started being talked about as a reality of something that we'll see in the future, it spiked my interest because I was already in leadership for both consumer attorneys in California, where most of the technology here in California is being developed, and also in leadership for AHA. And I saw a future where, and I saw a pattern of what was occurring with the gig economy and a lot of these tech companies putting out technology and essentially beta testing it on consumers. But at the same time, what they were doing was writing in forced arbitration into all of their contracts with these consumers. So essentially, the trend became, well, Uber's a great example. Uber didn't wait for permission or regulation and the state of California to tell them, go out and start your business, and here's how you should do it. You're a common carrier, like a taxi. Instead, they started putting the technology out on the road, and the state of California had to catch up with them because they said, we're not a taxi service. We're a technology company. We're just going to put this tech out there, and we'll, you know, you have to tell us that we have to be regulated. The same is becoming true with autonomous vehicles. And the Tesla's autonomous vehicle software or capabilities that they're putting in their cars. There was just an article that came out a couple of days ago about how NHTSA, which is the federal regulation agency that oversees highway and transportation, that they have warned that the technology that Tesla is selling currently in their vehicles to allow for autonomous driving from start to finish, point to point, completely autonomous, is essentially just being tested by the people that are purchasing it. Like that, the technology has not been approved, and that the federal government has not set regulations related to it. The technology is just putting out there. So you put a combination of potentially very dangerous technology out on the road. And I want to say that I'm an advocate for safety. In my core, that's what I am. So if there's technology that will be provided to consumers that will help the disabled to have more accessibility and be able to get around, and just individuals in general, if we can take out driver error and computer driving ends up being the safest way for our roadway system to work, I'm a huge advocate for that. But what I don't want to see is that we're putting technology out before its time, and then at the same time, we are providing protections for those companies that are just putting this stuff out there, and they're being protected from civil liability, which is how we're going to end up holding them accountable to make it safer. That combination is extremely dangerous. And so I have worked for many years with AJ specifically and with CAOC to make sure that there aren't legal protections for these companies, meaning that they don't get immunities from lawsuits and that they don't change the standards of how they're held accountable. Because those are two ways, that's just two of the ways. And then the third is what I mentioned before, which is putting forced arbitration into all their contracts. So yeah. Imagine, like, just with Uber, when you sign up for the Uber app, and I use Uber generally because this includes all rideshare companies. When you right. sign up for that app and you download it on your phone, you're accepting terms of service that the majority of us do not read. And you accept those terms of service. And in those terms of service, it says if you are injured as a result of our negligence, you don't have a right to a jury trial. You have to be forced into a secret system that's private, where whatever the result is cannot be shared with the public. And oftentimes the arbitrators are biased towards the company who they get repeat business from. So it's an incredibly dangerous combination. And I'm glad you mentioned this as an example, because that is where I see the focus of our very intense need to watch this space and to protect consumers in this space. And it, even though I'm done being president of both CAOC and AAJ, I continue to be a very strong advocate in that area because I am extremely concerned about it.
With the couple minutes we have left, can you, and I think I already know, but I want to still get you to articulate it. Can you talk a little bit about the culture in your law firm and what you believe is the secret to your success for you and your firm? I have a feeling it's a bit intertwined.
I think we've talked about the family aspect and the core empathy. But another area is surrounding ourselves with like-minded people who also know the law extremely well. So because all of us have done personal injury work and focused ourselves, personal injury, I should just say plaintiff's work, because we, like I mentioned before, we do a lot of class action work protecting consumer rights. We do mass tort work protecting consumer rights. We really do represent people and individuals in every area of the law that we can. But it is about knowing that area extremely well. So we really have specialists in our firm that are focused in different areas. So as I mentioned, I started off representing people in products liability, and you know, really those are complicated, detailed cases where you need to really know how to handle them, because they're so different than handling an individual slip and fall case or a car accident case. Just really different worlds. And then, you know, getting into new and evolving areas, such as the jail cases that I was talking about, you know, really thinking about how you can make good law for individuals for the future. So if you are in an innovative area, making sure that you know how to argue the law, apply it correctly, and represent the clients the best you can. That is a overall feeling in our firm. That is something that we cherish doing and that we all strive to do our best at. You need to be well versed in the law, and you need to be a very strong advocate and not be afraid to get into the courtroom. And we are in the courtroom constantly. Even during a pandemic, we are still one of the only law firms that has been able to continue to try cases. And that's really important to us.
All right, so last question before we wrap up, a bit selfishly, I'm interested in your take on any issues that you are experiencing when you're settling cases. You know, as a lawyer, I'm on the FJA listserv and some of the AHA listservs, and I see a lot of questions about Medicare and lien resolution issues, but I'm curious if you've seen any particular issues that you find increasingly difficult or more complex as part of your practice when you're resolving cases.
Liens, the issue of liens are is an ever-evolving area. We're watching, and I know that Synergy is involved in this as well, and you mentioned that you do Medicare in your own practice. Watching the changes of the rules related to Medicare and Medicare set-asides, which, you know, we've been sitting waiting to see what change might occur in that area for a long time. AHA has been heavily involved in trying to protect individuals protect their money and protect their justice for the future. And that's an area that is, because it's kind of teetering at the moment. We don't know exactly which way it's going to go. It's complicated, and not everyone is as versed in it as you are. And we often encounter misunderstandings with opposing counsel about how that area of the law currently stands. So that's a big challenge. Another challenge that we're facing, even more so during the pandemic right now, is representing minors. Every case involving a minor needs court approval. And when you have a significant backlog, the way that we are experiencing nationwide, really, but specifically in California, and I will say most specifically in Los Angeles, if you file a motion to approve what we call minors compromise, to approve the settlement, that hearing could be set out as long as 6 months from now, and or longer, honestly, because of the backlog. It was backlogged before, but the pandemic created a really, really critical situation where our clients finally get to a resolution, but they may not see any of that money and that settlement approved for 6 months to a year. That is wrong, and we're trying to deal with that. I know Consumer Attorneys of California is trying to deal with that, but it's a reality we're dealing with right now. So there's a lot of hurdles. Once a case, we were talking earlier about this. Once a case is finished, that doesn't mean you're done. And when I say finished, once you have a resolution with opposing counsel, with the defendant, there's so much work that still needs to continue, and those hurdles are changing, and it's very important for everybody to really kind of stay on top of it and do what you can do to make sure you continue to protect your client.
Yeah, we call it the case after the case. Thankfully, here in Florida, the minor settlements seem to be moving through the system, you know, fairly quickly with Zoom hearings and being approved. That's a problem that the California has not been able to get their system straight to at least, you know, provide a mechanism to get those things approved so that you don't have them sitting and waiting for 6 months. That's a very long period of time.
I was just going to say, in California, every county is very different. We have a lot of counties, and some are, and they're all individual. They're each court system is very different. There are some that where you can get it done within a very reasonable time, and others where they're just so backlogged that we have the troubles that I was talking about. But hopefully we can get that addressed and see some resolution for our clients.
So if anyone listening wants to get in contact with you and refer you a case, how's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, the best way to reach out to me is through email. That is, it's my first name. It's Elise at AS WT lawyers.com. And I am, I'm always happy to help people for any questions that they have on any of these areas of the law, whether it be related to California or not related to California. But I take calls daily from people just asking for information on a particular topic or help with a California issue. And I consider it part of my practice to help other trial lawyers. So I want to encourage your listeners to reach out to me if they think that I can help in any way, because I'm happy to do that.
Well, I'm very thankful that you took the time out of your day to be on the podcast today. And to our viewers, we'll see you next time on Trial Lawyer Review.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Trial Lawyer Review. You can find more at triallawyerreview.com and look for more episodes and more content coming in the future.